From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
Dear brave fellow citizens, liberated people, we won. We won in spite of the lies and violence of Slobodan Milosevic.
Hundreds of thousands rally against Milosevic in Yugoslavia. We'll go to Belgrade and listen to the speech of the opposition candidate. Also, a look at Hollywood and the elections, and why can't Olympic athletes keep diaries for their hometown newspapers? We'll take a look at intellectual property and the International Olympic Committee. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. An Indonesian court today abandoned the trial of ex-dictator Suharto after a medical team said he was too sick to face charges he embezzled millions of dollars in public funds. It also immediately freed him from house arrest. This also triggered clashes outside the court between hundreds of angry protesters, police, and supporters of Suharto, who pro-democracy forces drove from power in 1998 after 32 years in power. And this news from Washington, D.C. The Senate Foreign Relations Committee yesterday passed legislation which bans all U.S. military assistance to Indonesia. The committee passed the measure unanimously by voice vote. The bill now goes to the Senate floor. The legislation bans military cooperation with and assistance to the Indonesian Armed Forces until the president certifies certain conditions have been met by the Indonesian government and military, including safe return of refugees to East Timor and judicial accountability for military and militia members responsible for human rights violations in East Timor, Aceh, and other parts of Indonesia. Organizers insisted today that a new French aid flight to Baghdad will go ahead as planned this week in defiance of UN sanctions and despite pressures from the highest levels to cancel the operation. The leader of the charity Children of the World, which is one of the project's sponsors, said the aircraft will leave France for Baghdad tomorrow, a week after a first aid flight to the Iraqi capital drew U.S. protests. Among those expected to be on the flight are two former UN officials, Hans von Sponeck and Dennis Halliday. And this news from Prague, the headline this morning on the wires read, battle-weary capitalists wrapped up their global money summit a day early. We turn now to Prague with Julie Light, managing editor of Corporate Watch based in San Francisco, but she's in Prague. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Julie.
Thanks, Amy.
So do the protesters consider this a victory, the cutting by a day of the World Bank IMF meetings?
Absolutely. I think people here are very aware of the fact that the bank is affected by what has gone on over the last week here, by the demonstrations, by the meetings they've been having with NGOs. They've begun to even adopt some of the rhetoric about alleviating poverty. And what activists here are telling me is that the important thing now is, even as James Wolfensohn, the head of the bank, talks about 20% of the world controlling 80% of the resources, that they want to see real changes, concrete changes. They want concepts like the ecological debt brought into the debate. Who owes what to whom? If the North has plundered the South for years, how can it be that the South owes so much to the North?
And Julie, what about the protesters who've been arrested? What's happening with them? How many are in jail?
Confirmed, and organizers are telling me that they suspect the number is much higher. They've been sent to a prison about 50 miles from here towards the German border. They say women have been strip searched by male officers. People have been chained to walls and beaten, that they've been handcuffed, thrown down stairs. They've been pushed into cells, crowded into cells, denied food, water, and most importantly, access to legal representation and the phone call that they're all entitled to.
And what has been the response of, Václav Havel, the head of the Czech Republic, known for his own dissidents over the years?
Well, there's been silence. They can't get this into the Czech press and very little into the international press. That's the frustration that a lot of the the demonstrators are feeling now. They're dispersed. They closed down the Convergence Center. Little demonstrations are popping up in different places all over the city, and the police are, even with permitted allowed demonstrations, dispersing people. And they're very frustrated that they can't get the message out about what's happening to the people detained by the police.
Julie Light, I want to thank you for being with us, managing editor of Corporate Watch, based in San Francisco, in Prague right now for the protests against the World Bank and the IMF, which have just wrapped up their meetings. And you are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! You're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. In the middle of the night last night in Belgrade, Yugoslavia, the country's Federal Election Commission announced what it called the final results of last weekend's presidential election. Jeremy Scahill, Democracy Now! Correspondent, is in Belgrade. Jeremy, what was announced?
Well, exactly what the Federal Election Commission announced was what they had preliminarily announced yesterday, and that is that Vojislav Kostunica did not win enough votes to declare a first-round victory. The opposition is protesting this. They say that Kostunica had 48% to Milosevic's 38%. No sooner did the rally, massive rally, end last night in Belgrade, hundreds of thousands of people in the streets, than the Federal Election Commission made this announcement. Thousands upon thousands of people poured into the streets of the capital city, into the Republic Square, shaking babies' rattles, saying that Slobodan Milosevic had been broken like a baby's rattle. The man at the center of this rally was Vojislav Kostunica. He says he's the new president of Yugoslavia. He says there will be no second round. There is now talk of a general strike in Yugoslavia. We go now to the speech of Vojislav Kostunica in Republic Square in Belgrade last night.
Dear brave fellow citizens, liberated people, we won. We won in spite of the lies and violence of Slobodan Milosevic.
Pobedili smo uprkos sankcijama pod kojima smo godinama živeli. Pobedili smo uprkos natovskim bombama koje su.
We won in spite of the economic sanctions we lived under for years. We won in spite of the NATO bombs that were falling on our country last year. We won in spite of certain Democrats in Serbia and Montenegro that turned their backs on us. We won. In that lies our strength, maybe our stubbornness. But Serbia, the real Serbia, is in that.
Svi smo mi zajednički u nedelju rekli u kakvoj državi želimo da živimo. I ne samo da smo rekli, pokazali smo brojem glasova da iza te države stojimo.
All of us together said on Sunday what kind of a state we wish to live in. And we not only said that, we showed by the number of votes that we stand behind that state. That is the large majority of Serbia. This government has dared once again to be stubborn against the will of the people. They tried once again to steal the election from us. They tried to bargain about the second round of the elections. And we, from here, all together, are sending them the message that there is no second round. No bargaining. No bargaining with them. Why? We fight for democracy. Democracy rests in truth, not in lies. The truth is that we won these elections and that they lost these elections. If we would bargain with them, then we would accept lies instead of the truth. And democracy rests on truth. Besides that, democracy rests on the will of the people, on the will of the majority, and not on the will of one man. That is why there's no bargaining with them. Because if we would bargain, we would acknowledge that the will of one man, Slobodan Milosevic, is stronger than the will of the whole people. And there is no bargaining with them. There is no bargaining with them, but who are they? How many of them are left? How many of them are still around Slobodan Milosevic? Very few. The majority of Socialist Party members do not want to take part in another fraud with him. They don't want to share his destiny. They don't want to go down with him. At this moment, we are strong. Because finally we have the support of the world, we have the support of the European Union, we have the support of Russia. That support is important, yet not decisive. Our strength, embodied in these elections, is decisive. Our strength, our will, our determination to step on the neck of the whims of one man who thinks that he is untouchable are decisive. There will not be untouchable individuals in this country anymore. Only democracy and your will be untouchable. And untouchable will be the law that will rule this country instead of the arbitrariness of one individual. My message to the socialists is, we will not behave like your leadership. We will not persecute those who think differently. We will not take away the property of others. We will not jump into other people's houses and apartments. We will not destroy state-run companies and then buy them cheaply ourselves. We will not take the people's property out of this country. The people's property will stay in this country. We will do everything so that order, freedom, and peace start to rule this country. Sloboda i mir. Moja poruka vojsci i policiji glasi: Mi smo jedno. My message to the army and police is, we are one. The army and police are here, being part of the people, to defend the state and not one man and his family. Vojska i policija se tako do sad ponašala. The army and police behaved like that so far, and they will behave like that in the future. Why would our army, that honorably fought against NATO last year, now be afraid of one man? Why would it tremble in front of him? Why would it be a puppet in the hands of a strong man? For Slobodan Milosevic is just that, a strong man who remains now without strength, and the only thing he can do now is to realize that. No matter how much he will need to realize that. If he didn't realize that while he was in power, he will realize that when we separate him from power. Mi smo, dragi prijatelji, trebali večeras da se sastanemo na jednom drugom mestu ispred Savezne skupštine, naše skupštine. Oni su to sprečili. We were, dear friends, supposed to meet in a different place, in front of the federal parliament, our parliament. They disabled that. They dismantled our stage, because the Federal Election Commission, that has to fake the election results in peace, works there. Ona ista savezna izborna komisija koja je to učinila pre neku godinu i koja onda morala da priznaje. The very same election commission that did that several years ago and that was forced later to acknowledge the real results. But this time 88 days will not be necessary for them to acknowledge the truth. They have very little time less than 24 hours to come in front of the public with the real results of the elections. We will do everything, but I repeat once again, with nonviolence and not with violence as they do, to make sure this truth is publicized. We will fight for every vote. We will fight for the preservation of this state, but we will do everything so that after Milosevic's crimes and after last year's NATO bombardment, no drop of blood will fall again and no stone will fly again.
Mi imamo snage za to.
We have the strength for that. We will preserve the state. We will preserve ourselves. We are strong. We are strong because we liberated ourselves. The 24th of September is the confirmation of our great liberation, of the liberation of our great, beautiful Serbia and Yugoslavia. Let us live.
Opposition candidate Vojislav Kostunica speaking last night at a rally attended by hundreds of thousands of people in Belgrade, Yugoslavia. Joining us on the line, Jeremy Scahill, Democracy Now! Correspondent, one of the few foreign reporters in Belgrade right now. Jeremy, he has announced that they will not accept the runoff. What does it mean?
Well, opponents of Slobodan Milosevic have faced defeat after defeat after the last decade as they've tried to remove him from power. And what we're seeing today in Yugoslavia is a different optimism in the streets that this is the moment, that this is the time when the opponents of Milosevic are going to be victorious. So it could be the last stand of a man who has defied mass protest and resistance his entire time in power. But time and time again, Slobodan Milosevic has shown an uncanny ability to hold on against all predictions and against all odds. It seems clear that he is going to go ahead with this second round. Now, one of the things that we need to pay attention to is that it's very clear that the opposition is against Milosevic, but what has been less clear, certainly in the corporate media, is what they're in favor of. As you know, the U.S. Congress this week approved a massive amount of aid, in excess of $100 million, to what it calls democratic forces within Yugoslavia. This is on top of the $77 million that's already pouring into the country to groups opposed to Slobodan Milosevic. This money pipeline has raised charges that what the United States is doing is what it's done in so many countries, and that is to interfere in the internal affairs of a sovereign country. As you know, members of the opposition have met regularly with people like U.S. Secretary of State Madeleine Albright and the U.S. Ambassador to the U.N. Richard Holbrooke. These were the key players in the NATO bombing, the people pressing for the bombardment, the 78-day bombardment of Yugoslavia. The person from the opposition most frequently charged with being a servant of NATO is Zoran Djindjic, who is actually Vojislav Kostunica's campaign manager. He's also head of the Democratic Party here in Yugoslavia. I had a chance yesterday to confront Zoran Djindjic, one of the key members of the Democratic Opposition of Serbia, about these meetings that he had with Madeleine Albright and Richard Holbrooke and about this U.S. money pipeline flowing into Yugoslavia.
The United States has pledged $77 million to groups opposed to Slobodan Milosevic, and you've been one of the main people that has been attacked as a NATO servant. How do you view all of this money that the U.S. is pledging? I mean, how can you respond to charges that you're a NATO servant?
We didn't receive this money. We think that independent media and maybe NGOs through different projects received this money, but political parties not. Not only from America, from other countries too, and it is forbidden, prohibited in Yugoslavia. And in the case to receive the money, the Milosevic would of course know, and he would prohibit our parties. And it is very, very high risk for us to take the money, and this is also high risk for foreign governments. It is not allowed in this country as governments to support parties in foreign countries. And I don't understand this kind of statements now again about $500 million and $50 million for opposition or some activities. If we add all these sums, we would receive millions and hundred millions from foreign countries. And I can, as a campaign manager, say to you, we spend less than $500,000 in our campaign.
Zoran Djindjic is the campaign manager for the opposition candidate Vojislav Kostunica. We're going to go back to that interview Jeremy Scahill did with him yesterday after the protest rally in Belgrade. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! First, we have to break for 60 seconds. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue in Belgrade, Yugoslavia, after the speech last night of the opposition candidate Vojislav Kostunica, who said that the opposition will not accept what has been laid out by Slobodan Milosevic, a runoff for the presidency of Yugoslavia. Democracy Now! Correspondent Jeremy Scahill spoke with Zoran Djindjic, who is the campaign manager for Kostunica, and had asked him, as we were listening before the break, about the tens of millions of dollars that has been pouring in from the United States. He was talking about, Zoran Djindjic, when we broke, the amount of money that they have put into, that the opposition has put into their campaign.
This campaign did cost less than $500,000, about million German mark. And with all this money, I don't know what to do with $5 million as party in Serbia. He knows, but he's not party.
But there are some, though, that say it was inappropriate for you to meet with Madeleine Albright, given that she was one of the leaders of the bombing of your country.
That's the reality. I cannot choose who is Secretary of State in America. I appreciate America as a very important country, and I think that without strategic partnership and friendship with America and Europe, we cannot be successful in this region. We want to have common interests, of course, to protect our interests, but protect our interests through cooperation with important countries in the world, with Russia, America, Europe. And I don't want to influence the personal politics in Washington. I cannot say Madeleine Albright is not okay. They should have other people and or other person. We should accept reality. And reality is that the world politics is like climate. That is, you can try to live with that, or you are dead. And Milosevic is trying to change the international climate, to change American politics. That is stupid. We want to try to accept the reality and to create better future for our children in the real world, not imagined by us.
But there are some that say that it's insensitive to the population of Yugoslavia to meet with someone like Madeleine Albright, who was so vehemently in favor of bombing Yugoslavia. I'm not talking about how it plays globally. I'm talking about to the population here that suffered immensely from that bombing.
Yes, but that's investment in the future. I think politicians should do unpopular things if they are useful for their country. And I think it would be very dangerous to try to be popular in the country and not to do right things. I have my opinion about Madeleine Albright, about NATO, about this kind of politics.
What is your opinion?
It's not very, very high opinion. I think NATO did huge mistakes, and I don't think that it's, that the people are very able by analyzing situation and acting appropriately. I don't think that, that they do right things, but that is reality. And I think I choose this way to maybe to be not very popular in Serbia, but to be a bridge between Serbia and Europe. First of all, Europe, and then America. And I think someone should do this. And Mr. Kusturica should do other things. And all together we cover national politics and mood of the people in Serbia, but also international politics. And we are a small country and we are a small nation, and we should try to use all opportunities in the country and in the world to bring better future for our people. And I do this with plan. That is not. I know what the costs are, very, very well. But I think the benefits in the future are huge, and not for me personally, but for this country.
Zoran Djindjic is the opposition campaign manager for Vojislav Kostunica, speaking to Jeremy Scahill last night in Belgrade, Yugoslavia. Jeremy, as we wrap up, the latest news from Belgrade.
Well, just one comment on the interview with Zoran Djindjic. One of the statements that he made, I think a lot of people I've talked to here find it shocking that he referred to his meetings with Madeleine Albright as an investment in the future, given the fact that she was so key to the massive bombardment of this country. We've just gotten word in the last few moments on a different subject that the patriarch of the Serbian Orthodox Church, Patriarch Pavla, a very important figure here, has recognized the election victory of Vojislav Kostunica and appealed to him to come to power in a peaceful manner. This is very significant because this is a largely Orthodox country. People do rely on the word of the patriarch. Once again, he has confirmed from his office that they believe that Vojislav Kostunica is the new president of Yugoslavia.
Jeremy, thank you very much for being with us. Jeremy Scahill, Democracy Now! Correspondent in Belgrade, Yugoslavia, will be continuing to bring you his reports. And you are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. As we turn now to another international issue, it is the Olympics. When a U.S. Olympic athlete agreed to have her personal diary of the Sydney 2000 Games published in a local newspaper in Kansas City, the International Olympic Committee stepped in and said no. They also said no to athletes involved in online chats and no again to internet live streaming of footage filmed of any Olympic event. The reason? The IOC effectively owns the intellectual property rights in sporting events and also of those seeking to cover sporting events. And only recently has the Olympic Committee begun to crack down the ever-expanding universe of the internet, representing a new threat for the property of the Olympics. We're going to talk about this right now with two people. Siva Vaidyanathan is a professor of communications at New York University, and he has a book coming out called Copyrights and Copy Wrongs, The Rise of Intellectual Property and How It Threatens Creativity. Michael Persinger is also with us. He's sports editor of the Charlotte Observer in North Carolina. Well, let's talk about this. An interesting piece in the New York Times earlier this week by Felicity Barringer, leery of the web, Olympic officials set limits on the news. These athletes who used to, you know, keep hometown journals for their local papers are being told no. Why?
Well, this is one example of a whole series of rights that athletes are signing away in the process of assuming the privilege of participating in this event. And I mean, athletes are in one sense under duress. They dream of participating in this event their entire lives. They dream of representing their towns and their states and their countries. And then once they reach that point, the Olympic Committee finds all sorts of ways of restricting their behavior. Now, this isn't obviously the only right they sign away. They also sort of, you know, sign away the rights to their urine, for instance, and that becomes a major factor in the Olympics. But it's what you have here is not an obvious threat to free speech, because in some way they willingly do sign away their rights, but in other ways it's not very willing. I mean, they don't want to have to back out of the games in exchange for having the rights to describe their experiences firsthand during the course of the games. Of course, later they can write the accounts of their experiences after the games are over.
And then, of course, you also have NBC not allowing the video images of the events to be aired by other networks because they've got the exclusive rights. And at the same time, NBC is tanking in the Arbitron ratings and, you know, viewership around this country. And you can't help but wonder when CNN has just a photograph of someone winning a swimming team event, if NBC is really doing itself in, and that part of the reason for this rating slump is that they're not allowing others to build the buzz, and so that we all watch the other networks and we want to watch this race at night and we'll tune into NBC.
Well, a couple of interesting things are happening. With the rise of digital technology, the digitization of just about every form of content and culture, simultaneously with the network effect, all of these companies that rely on concentrating information or monopolizing expression are panicking. They're afraid of a spillover, of a leaky system. And so they're trying any way they can to close leaks of information and expression. And there are three major strategies for closing leaks, for creating a closed system of information. There's copyright law. That's our longest and deepest, our most familiar way, and actually our most democratic way of regulating the distribution of information and expression. Then there's contract, and that seems to be what we're getting at here. NBC and the IOC are relying on very heavy, exclusive contracts to make sure that they are the primary providers of images, especially live moving images. So as a result, the IOC has denied press passes to web journalists. They have allowed what you might call, you know, standard or mainstream journalists who work for institutions that also have websites, ABC, for instance, CNN, for instance, ESPN, for instance. But they are heavily restricting the distribution of images. So they're allowing the distribution of still images after the fact, but not moving images during it. And I think that, yes, I think you're right. People are sensing that there is such a high level of control here that they're willing to sort of help break down the system. It's sort of the same reason that people get a big kick out of using Napster, because it pokes a hole in the system that media companies are trying to create around all forms of culture and expression.
In the New York Times piece about the limits being set on news, it talks about Siri Mulinix, who is the North Carolina-born goalkeeper of the women's soccer team, stopped her online chats with the Greensboro News and Record and said she couldn't contribute a diary during the games. The Hartford Courant got the same message from Karen Scavotto, the 18-year-old archer from Enfield, Connecticut. The 27th Olympic Games may be remembered for many things, world records, peacetime, logistical planning, but it will surely be a benchmark in the struggle between those who hold intellectual property rights in sporting events and those seeking to cover sports, especially for the ever-expanding universe of the news outlets on the web. And it goes on to say that the gradual fencing off of information and imagery by sports franchises was well underway before the Olympics. In the last few years, debates have been joined over whether game developments can be distributed instantly by pager. They can, a federal appeals court has ruled. Earlier this year, NASCAR, the stock car racing league, backed off an attempt to make reporters agree that NASCAR was sole owner of images, sounds, and data arising from and during any NASCAR event, including the racing times and scoring information. Michael Persinger, that's where you come in, sports editor of the Charlotte Observer in North Carolina, the epicenter of the NASCAR universe. Can you explain how you challenge this?
Well, what we did was we went back at NASCAR and tried to negotiate some ways around what they wanted to do. I mean, they're like the Olympics and like the NFL in that they're trying to protect the people who have their TV contracts. I mean, that is an exclusive contract, and they're trying to protect those folks who are paying a whole lot of money for the information. They don't want instant information out there in any other form that they can't control. So what we did was they had tried to protect all the intellectual rights. Anything that happened at a racetrack, interviews, pictures taken, anything could not be used. You know, the NASCAR was saying they kept the copyright to it. And as a newspaper, we couldn't agree to that. You know, that's pretty much basic to what we do. We wanted the ability to use the information we gathered in any way we saw fit. So we went back to NASCAR and talked to John Griffin, who's their director of communications worldwide, and negotiated with him kind of an addendum to the credential letter that they asked us to sign. And it protected the rights that we wanted to protect as far as copyright, as far as being able to promote our product, as far as being able to be known as a paper that was had strong NASCAR coverage and to promote that fact. So, you know, we used a contractual remedy to maintain the rights that we felt we deserved anyway.
Siva Vaidyanathan.
Yeah, this is a really fascinating case. You have a situation where copyright law has always allowed for the free flow of information, facts, data, ideas, but it's only restricted specific expression that's sort of fixed, either fixed on paper, fixed on video, fixed on sound recording, and so forth. So obviously a newspaper does its job by being able to take advantage of this democratic safeguard in copyright law. Well, the democratic safeguard in copyright law does NASCAR no good. It does the NFL no good, and it certainly does the IOC no good. So they're using very strong strong-arm tactics to extract contractual terms from a newspaper like Charlotte Observer. And it's something that people should be very aware of. There is no way that they could protect, for instance, race times or the list of finishers in order unless they can get the newspapers to sign away the rights to distribute that information freely. How do they do that? They don't allow them access to the arena, to the track in the first place. That press pass is a contract. By accepting the press pass, you're agreeing to certain behaviors. Most of them are reasonable. You know, you're not supposed to run naked through the stands. You're not supposed to beat up fans, et cetera. You're not supposed to. I'm sure there are very few content related restrictions. I've used press passes before, and there haven't been. But the restrictions they're starting to introduce are these sorts of things, so that they can extract monopoly benefits from each bit of information.
Michael Persinger, as a reporter at the Charlotte Observer, are you concerned about all these hometown Olympic people who cannot share their views as they go along because it's considered proprietary information, not their property, but of the IOC and their relationship with NBC?
I think as a journalist, you have to be concerned with anything that restricts the flow of information. I mean, sports is one thing, and if information starts being restricted in political arenas and other areas like that, that's a very serious thing. And sports, because of the money involved, because of the TV contracts involved and the amount of money that people are paying for the right to televise stuff, they're trying to protect that. NASCAR has a new TV contract coming in next year. With NBC and Fox, the main two groups that are doing that, and they were this season in the last season of the old TV contracts trying to start to put in some of these restrictions so that the information wouldn't get out in ways that they didn't want it to.
You know, we can go beyond sports. I remember 2 years ago, and we just excerpted it just a few days ago here, when the U.S. government was trying to build a drumbeat for a continued bombing of Iraq. CNN had the exclusive rights to a Sandy Berger, Madeleine Albright, William Cohen event at Ohio State in Columbus, Ohio. So here you had them confronting U.S. population, did not expect the kind of protest that they got from a arena filled with people. And when we wanted to play many minutes of this, because it was truly a news event, CNN is saying you can't play more than a certain number of seconds.
Yeah, you know, CNN can demand that, you have a fair use right to reasonably take from it. But there's no firm line in there. So it's something that originally you could negotiate with CNN if you wanted to. But, I mean, they have so much power to deny you and then drag you through court for years. And this is one thing every journalist is afraid of. Everything a journalist does is time sensitive. Journalists can't afford to drag things through court or they lose it. Now, it's really interesting, we don't need to make a distinction between sports and politics. Look at how the IOC handled the politics of Salt Lake City and the state of Utah. There was a crossover between a political situation and a sports situation, and it's a situation that required ultimately maximum exposure to every step of the process. If the IOC is in the business of restricting people looking at it in all its different somewhat sleazy activities, we're in real danger.
Well, I want to thank you both for being with us. Siva Vaidyanathan, who is the professor of communications at New York University. I'm looking forward to your book, Copyrights and Copy Wrongs, The Rise of Intellectual Property and How It Threatens Creativity. Michael Persinger joining us from Charlotte, sports editor of the Charlotte Observer, involved in the challenging case with NASCAR in North Carolina. When we come back, we're going to Washington and Hollywood. Stay with us. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. As we go now to talk about Hollywood and the Olympics, and the second, rather, Hollywood and politics, though they can all be confused. In the second round of this year's culture wars between Washington and Hollywood, the Motion Picture Association of America yesterday pledged the Senate Commerce Committee that they would curb but not guarantee an end to marketing movies with violent content to underage audiences. Hollywood executives offered a 12-point plan designed to address a Federal Trade Commission report released earlier this month that accused Hollywood of aggressively marketing violent films, music, and video games to kids. The report had been ordered by President Clinton last year, shortly after the high school shootings in Littleton, Colorado, in response to fears that raw popular culture had furnished some of the mental climate in which the killers' grievances festered. In last week's Senate Commerce hearing, chaired by Senator John McCain, Vice Presidential nominee Joseph Lieberman and Liz Cheney, former chair of the NEH and wife of the Republican nominee for vice president, found themselves on common ground, both decrying the state of the entertainment industry. Vice President Al Gore and Senator Lieberman gave the entertainment industry 6 months to shape up its marketing practices or face unnamed retaliation from Washington. But at a movie industry fundraising event days later, the Democratic nominees for president and vice president softened their tone considerably and assured their Hollywood supporters that they didn't actually intend to censor them, just hope for more self-regulation from the industry. We're joined right now by Dan Gerstein, who is a spokesperson for Senator and Vice Presidential nominee Joseph Lieberman. Can you tell us what Joseph Lieberman's stance is of what does he think of the movie industry's response to Washington's criticism?
Well, Senator Lieberman said yesterday that he thought that this was a good first step, and he praised the industry for at least acknowledging that there's a problem here. That the FTC documented, that they have some responsibility to parents to fix it. And they came forward with some tangible steps to limit the marketing to of adult-rated violent products to children, and also to, and this is a, really a key point, to provide more information to parents about the content of the movies that they're producing, because that's been a long-time criticism of the MPAA rating system, is that there's an age-based determination, in this case R, but it's not identified what the content is, what's the reason for the rating, and they've pledged in the future to provide that information. However, a major flaw and the fatal flaw in the program they put forward was that they did not explicitly say they will have a prohibition against the marketing of adult-rated violent products to children and that they will enforce it. And that is what the FTC recommended, and that's what Vice President Gore and Senator Lieberman said had to be the bottom line here.
Henry Jenkins is also with us, director of comparative media studies at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. After the Littleton shootings, you were called to Washington to testify before a similar committee and hearing like we've had in the last weeks. What is your response to the spokesperson for Senator Lieberman? Are you with us? Professor Jenkins? We'll go to him in a second. Well, let's get our third guest on the line with us, Mark Crispin Miller, professor of media studies and director of Project on Media Ownership at New York University. You take a slightly different tack in looking at the industry and the corporate power behind it.
Yeah, I'd say so. I think actually it's beside the point to treat this whole controversy in terms of culture war it's tempting to do so, but it's really too easy. I mean, we can look at it in melodramatic terms and say that Hollywood is being either oppressed or reined in by a bunch of oppressive or righteous politicians. It seems to me that it's not only reasonable but necessary to take steps to protect children from inappropriate programming, and that's not an elitist move. Anyone with kids knows that it's a real struggle to have to keep your children from being exposed to images that are just simply traumatic for them. And this is why a good many enlightened democracies have strict policies against marketing anything to children. The Swedes, for example, just forbid it. It's illegal to market to children, which, if you think about it, is only sane and just because kids are kids and they can't make the kinds of sophisticated distinctions between truth and lie or between one kind of fiction and another that adults presumably can make. I think that the problem here is that the media industries are far too large and powerful on the one hand and heavily indebted on the other, indebted and therefore desperate for whatever revenues they can scare up. This is why they've been going around not so secretly marketing to kids. They need those viewers. They need those little kids in the theaters the way the tobacco companies used to need kids smoking and still do in many parts of the world. So while I applaud the efforts of the Vice President and Senator Lieberman to hold Hollywood accountable to its own rules when it comes to marketing stuff to kids, I think they should cut that out. I also am pretty skeptical about the possibilities of either of these political parties really doing what needs to be done, which is an actual movement of media reform to make the media both more competitive, more diverse, and capable of providing genuinely different kinds of content to genuinely different audiences. In other words, we will always have stuff such as they're, you know, attacking in Hollywood these days. That'll always be with us. You can't do away with it, and you shouldn't try.
But specifically, what are you proposing?
Well, I'm proposing vigorous antitrust measures. I'm proposing that we vastly enlarge and enrich the public media sector. Right now, we have public broadcasting of public TV and radio. They're national. They're not local. Countries like Australia, you know, they have a state-subsidized film industry. I know it sounds insane inside the United States, but that's the industry that gave us truly innovative and fascinating films like Babe and Splash, which then the Hollywood system struggled desperately to imitate. The fact is that if you're ruled only and always by bottom-line considerations and always and only going after the largest audience, you're going to go for the lowest common denominator. What we need to do is make our media across the board actually more productive, more diverse, less timid, less market-driven, and therefore less, less lubricious and less violent.
Let's bring Professor Jenkins back into the conversation from MIT. You testified after the Littleton, Colorado hearings. You were not sharing the views of most who testified then.
Yeah, I think that's a fair statement. I share most of what I just heard. That is, I think the goal should be broadening diversity, not regulating the content that's currently available. And I would support restrictions on advertising for children. But I'm troubled by the introduction of this culture war vocabulary into our discussion of popular culture. I'm troubled, for example, when I hear Senator Lieberman using phrases like cultural pollution or filth, because those words have a history. And they first surfaced in relation to movies at the turn of the century, at a point in which the WASP Society was using them to segregate out Jews and Italians, who were among the first producers of films and the first exhibitors of films, that those words originated in the context of a kind of nativist argument about who had the right to contribute to our culture. I'm concerned about the use of a phrase like lowest common denominator in a discussion of democracy. When we have someone like Orrin Hatch stand up at one of the hearings and say that Marilyn Manson's music is offensive to everyone in America who thinks, what is he saying about the many, many young people in America who do not find this music offensive, who feel that it says something important about contemporary culture? If popular culture appeals to the lowest common denominator, then what does that say about democracy? Democracy shouldn't be founded on the assumption that people are stupid, have bad taste, and are easily swayed by cultural materials. We have to assume, to have a functional democracy, that people have the ability to wade through the good and the bad and make their own decision. And what we're hearing out of Washington has been a series of ideological distinctions between good and bad violence, between clear and present danger in the Basketball Diaries, between The Patriot and Scream, that I think reflect the values of a particular segment of the population that are being promoted as if they were commonsensical and as if this was simply a battle between Hollywood and America rather than between different segments of the American culture who are struggling to express alternative values.
Spokesperson for Joseph Lieberman, Dan Gerstein, your response.
Well, first of all, I want to say up front that we are big fans of Professor Miller's work. He's done more than anyone, really, to kind of educate people about the implications of the concentration of power within the media and how that affects the products that flow into our culture. And one of the implications of that is a real lack of accountability. We're seeing that in some of these hearings in Washington about the marketing strategies. Some of the CEOs and some of the top studio officials are saying they had no idea that this was going on. And I think that's, you know, one of the things that we can do through this process, and by, you know, with respect to the First Amendment, without regulating content, because no one is, that I know of, is actually proposing that, but is to raise awareness about, well, this is the culture, this is the media structure we have right now, and what happens when there is accumulation of power and in very small, very few hands, there is a lack of accountability, in large part because people don't know, these companies are so big, people don't, at the top, don't know what the people at the bottom are doing. But getting to Professor Jenkins' point, I understand what he's saying, but, you know, this is something where it comes, first of all, we're talking right now about the marketing, and I'm glad to hear him say that, you know, there should be some accountability for marketing practices that target kids. But, you know, this, I hate the vocabulary of the culture war, too, because we're not attacking Hollywood. Sarah Lieberman's a big fan of the entertainment industry. He's a big fan of movies, big fan of television. His concern, though, is that so much of what's getting produced so glorifies violence and sends the worst message to kids. And what Professor Jenkins is talking about, he's exactly right. When it comes to adults, they should have the right to distinguish between, you know, high culture, low culture, and good violence and bad violence. And, you know, the First Amendment protects that right. But when it comes to kids, they're not little adults. They do not have the mental faculties always to make those distinctions. And we have to kind of have a special consideration for the fact that they are often vulnerable to the kind of violence and sexual messages that too often is flowing through our culture. And that's what we're trying to have a discussion about, is can we find a way to respect the First Amendment while also being more responsibility in the kind of culture that we immerse our kids
in? Let me go back to the first point you were raising with Professor Miller about the large corporations that run Hollywood. There was joking last week about Lieberman and Gore coming out hard and heavy against Hollywood and then going to a campaign fundraiser and softening their stance as they filled their coffers. You, Professor Miller, have come out with some very important graphs, charts, that show the entertainment industrial complex.
Yeah, the project on media ownership, which I directed at NYU, was set up with the purpose of acquainting the public with the facts about who owns what, and also with providing arguments or explanations as to why this kind of concentration is undemocratic and destructive. I want to say that I'm thrilled to the depths of my soul that the Gore Lieberman people think that my work is so important. And if they really want to have an open discussion of this whole problem, I'm available. You know, I can take the Amtrak down any time. The fact is,
this offer, Professor Miller.
All right, I'll hold you to that. But the fact is that there is a very close relationship. There is a correlation between increasing concentration and conglomeratization of the media industries and the downward spiral of the quality of the content. And having said that, I want to address Professor Jenkins's point. He's absolutely right when he says that this kind of rabid discourse has a long and really ugly pedigree. When you talk about things like filth and pollution, you're basically using the language of the Nazis and the Stalinists. You know, it's a kind of insane, puritanical opprobrium, you know, that whose purpose is really to vilify groups of people. Now, the right wing in this country, people like Lynn Cheney and William Bennett, invariably invoke the names only of the Jewish CEOs when they attack Hollywood, which is a good one, because one of the most important players in this universe is Rupert Murdoch. And interestingly enough, Rupert Murdoch is now supporting Gore. from what I read. The Staples Center, which is 40% owned by Rupert Murdoch's News Corporation, was donated to the Democrats. And Rupert has otherwise made clear to Gore that he supports him, as he has supported Tony Blair in the past, and as he has supported Australia's Labor government. Now, one other point, Amy. It's all very well to claim that moralistic language used to condemn some of the crappier aspects of mass culture, and in that I would include the network news on TV. It's all very well to condemn that. But I think we have to avoid idealizing a lot of this stuff. As Professor Jenkins was talking, I couldn't help but think of how Rupert Murdoch would be responding to what he was saying, because Rupert Murdoch is indeed extremely cynical. Rupert Murdoch has indeed and demonstrably lowered the quality of newspapers all over the world. There is such a thing as a high journalistic standard. The fact is that mass audiences have in the past been treated with tremendous respect. You know, throughout the 19th century, there were productions of operas and Shakespeare directed only for working class audiences. The great paperback revolution in this country was meant to make good books available to most people who couldn't afford it. So I think that, you know, simply to assume that the randiest stuff or the most violent stuff is what the masses want and deserve to have is itself elitist.
Dan Gerstein.
I couldn't agree more. And it's sort of insulting to the general public to think that, all they want is sex and violence. And, you know, I think the best evidence to prove Professor Miller's point is that in the 1950s, when you had a limited television network universe, and granted there were not as many outlets as there are today, but people were not rising up in the streets and clamoring for feel-good killings and, you know, recreational sex depictions. They were quite satisfied with Sid Caesar and your show of shows and high-quality television. And it wasn't until there was a lowering of standards by the producers that fed a taste for some of the more troubling material that's out there. And when Professor Jenkins starts saying that Marilyn Manson is somehow a valid artist, when you hear about what he says and how, you know, you talk about cynical.
All right, let me, Dan, jump in here. In
10 seconds.
In Professor Jenkins' defense, we can't really operate by deciding ourselves what stuff's good and what stuff's bad.
We have to cut off the debate here, but okay. I want to ask if you can all join us again tomorrow for the second part of this discussion, because it is too important and a major issue of our time. Dan Gerstein, spokesperson for Senator Lieberman, Mark Crispin Miller, professor at NYU, Henry Jenkins, director of comparative media studies at MIT. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.